The Large Nerdron Collider podcast is a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey everybody, welcome to The Large Nerdron Collider, the podcast that's all about the geeky things happening in the world around us and how very excited we are about them. I'm Ariel Kasten, and with me as always is bumping his mic, Jonathan Strickland.
I'm still buffering and bumping. Hey, Ariel.
Yes, Jonathan?
I got a question for you. Okay, Ariel, here's your question. It's more of a scenario, as I am wont to do. You have landed the job to design, locate, and build the next Hall of Doom for the Legion of Doom. Where do you put it?
Where do I put the next Hall of Doom?
Yes, where would you locate the Hall of Doom where all the supervillains gather for their supervillainry?
Underneath the La Brea tar pits.
Okay, so you're torturing so what you're doing is you're defeating evil by taking on a contract and then locating their villainous lair in a very inconvenient, sticky place.
I mean, a lot of supervillains like kind of gross places, so I assume it's right up their alley. I also assume they have the evil tech to survive the tar and would pick a location like that. I picked a location, but they would desire that location because it would keep other people out while their evil tech would allow them to survive quite comfortably there.
That's fair. I see your answer, and I brook no argument with it.
And maybe they'll bring saber-tooth tigers back. I'm assuming there are saber-tooth tigers in the La Brea tar pits.
I mean, you know, it stands to reason.
I've never actually been. What about you, Jonathan?
Wow, I like your answer a lot. Mine is Orlando, Florida.
No!
Yeah, Orlando, Florida is where I'm going to locate it.
Is that because you want to join and you spend so much time there?
No, it's mostly because I think that Florida in recent years has been a bit of a mess, and it just seems like that would be like putting it smack dab in the middle of the state would make the most sense. I think Florida's the right answer. And I could put it on, say, one of the Florida Keys, and then we wouldn't ever have to worry about the Legion of Doom ever again because they would be so mellow. They would never get around to doing evil because they would just all be burnt out, sitting on the beach, listening to Jimmy Buffett. In which case, I just won. So maybe I do put them on the Keys instead.
I mean, I don't know if a key could support their evil. Like, what if they just destroy it and sink to the bottom of the ocean? I guess win-win. I've never been to the Florida Keys. I assume that they're just floating sandbars.
No, they're islands. I mean, it's not like walking in the Okefenokee. By the way, if you don't know, in the Okefenokee, you get these areas that look like they're solid ground, but in fact, it's like a bunch of stuff that's all kind of glommed together, and it's like walking on a waterbed until you walk on a thin patch, and then you fall through, and then you get to learn how to remove leeches. It's fun stuff, great for the whole family. But no, the Florida Keys are solid islands.
I've never fallen into the Okefenokee. I've visited it once, but there were like walking paths and trails. I might visit it again this month, actually.
Oh, exciting. Yeah. I love the Okefenokee. Yeah, no, I'm talking about going deep into the swamp as opposed to, you're probably talking about like the Okefenokee Park.
Yes.
Where you can go there. Yeah, I love that park. It's a great park. I have never actually gone deep into the swamp. I'm not a swamp person. I've just seen video of that, and it's fascinating and terrifying, especially when you sit there and think about some of the stuff that's in the Okefenokee. I'm not so much worried about the alligators, but the snapping turtles are vicious, and then there are all the different kinds of snakes.
I mean,
those are the ones that worry me.
It sounds almost like a D&D adventure, Jonathan, and you do like those.
Yeah, and that's a great way to segue. Thank you, Ariel. Very good job. So if you did not know, this episode that we are doing, bringing to you right now, this is what we in the biz call a buffer episode. And the purpose of this is so that we have episodes to cover when one of us is absent. And this one's going out while I'm on vacation. So
lucky duck.
We won't be bringing any news because we can't predict what's going to happen in a couple of weeks. but we are going to talk a bit about D&D. And I'm just curious, well, first of all, not just D&D, but role-playing games in general. Ariel, what was your first exposure to role-playing games? Was it Dungeons & Dragons, or was it something else?
I knew about Dungeons & Dragons, but I think that my first actual exposure to role-playing games, outside of, like, theater, I was a theater kid, you know, which is kind of role-playing. It is. I was in a Shakespeare troupe when I was a teenager, and I was doing some Shakespeare play. I think maybe it was Hamlet, and I made friends with a guy who, real cool dude, who LARPed. And he was like, I think you'd enjoy this. And I said, I think you're right. And I had been trying to get into the Georgia Renaissance Festival. And when I was 18, I went to the Georgia Renaissance Festival and I went to my first LARP, which was actually you opened a can of worms. It was actually like a little LARP convention. And there were a few like one-shot games that went on. So I got to play a few different characters and got sucked right in. And then that group brought me into like D&D and 7Cs and things like that. You?
Well, first of all, it's fascinating to me that you jumped right into the deep end. You skipped the pencil and paper stage and went straight to full immersion in your role playing.
You dive into the deep end and then you wade back to like the shallow end. Because if you dive into the shallow end, you're just going to break your neck.
Yeah, I gently waded into the shallow end. So my first exposure was to basic Dungeons and Dragons, because that's what it was called back in the day. Because you got to remember, I was born in the 70s. So basic D&D, I have a memory of my dad trying to get me interested in it. And I was more interested in throwing the dice at the time. That's mm-hmm. the kind of age I was. So I wasn't quite mature enough to really care about the mm-hmm. game. It wouldn't be until I was in middle school and high school and I started playing Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, which also used to be a thing. And then they came out with Advanced Dungeons and Dragons Second Edition, which made a lot of the mechanics of D&D much more simple. So for those who aren't familiar, obviously, you know, role-playing games consist of both a premise and a set of rules to help guide how a story unfolds. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I fell into the same trap that a lot of people fall into early on in role-playing games, and that the rules became the most important component for me as opposed to telling a story. That would change over time, but it took a while to learn.
From the get-go, I'm like, I just want to role-play. I want to act. I don't want the rules.
Yeah. Well, see, it's too often that you find people who are into rule playing is what it tends to derogatorily be called, but it's where you really focus on like the stats of a character, right? You're trying to maximize your stats and mm-hmm. minimize any weaknesses you have. You know, you have people who are fudging dice rolls in order to get that 18 double zero strength for their warrior, or maybe it's even a wizard. They're like, no, I still want 18 double zero. And you say, well, that doesn't apply to that class. It doesn't matter. So D&D was like my first, like that was, mm-hmm. and, I actually was a game master way more than I was a player, but that was my exposure to role-playing games. And since then, I've played tons. I played Paranoia, which is a comedy sci-fi game in which you're pretty much guaranteed to get wiped out before the game's mm-hmm. over. I've played Star Wars role-playing game. I played a Marvel superhero and a DC superhero role-playing game. I've played Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Ghostbusters, Toon, tons of different games. Although if you listen to those, you'll notice that they're all like centered around the late 80s, early to mid 90s. That was like the heyday of my game playing. And since then, I have not really played any role-playing games.
So I started with 7Cs, which is you have like D10s, I think, and you have little dots for each of your, like your skills and then your stats. And you roll that many dice. So if I have like a 3 in charisma and then a 2 in seduction or whatever, because I played a courtier, it was like a high seas. It was like a Pirates of the Caribbean swashbuckling sort of political game. Then you would roll 5d10 and you'd keep the stat amount. So 5d10, keep 3, which was real easy for me. So when I jumped into D&D, and I played a lot of them, I played Ravensloft, I played Midnight, I played Big Eyes, Small Mouth, I played, I think it was Orient Adventures, though that was short-lived, and I don't super remember it. I've also played other games. I've played Changeling, I've played Monster of the Week, I've played Amber Diceless role-playing system, I've played a game called Heroes or something, where figuring out your character build and then doing anything with it was like doing calculus.
Oh, yeah. No, there was a game I had where I never got beyond making a character, because just making a character was like a 3-hour long process. And there literally was, and I'm not making this up, a roll that you had to make during the character creating process where if you rolled badly enough, your character died before you ever played your character. Like, literally while you're making your character, it turns out that part of your character's backstory is they failed to survive something. Mm. And you think, why was this even put into the game? What's the purpose of this apart from like some developer trolling me? The explanation for 7Cs makes me think of also Champions, which I think only uses 6-sided die. It's another superhero role-playing game. And you also made me think of another one, GURPS, Generic Universal Role-Playing System, which is an underlying set of rules. And the idea was you could use the same set of rules for all sorts of different settings. So you could have detective film noir setting, you could have Western, you could have high fantasy, you could have science fiction, but you would have the same generic set of rules that would underlie whatever campaign setting you chose.
Mm-hmm. I mean, D20 has kind of done that as well. And then I've played games. So I used to tabletop a lot, and then I took a long, long break from it. And now I'm just starting to tabletop again. My friends that I gained through my husband were all playing a game of Call of Cthulhu, where it started out the same way. Everybody started in the same setting and then went from there with new characters each time. So that was a lot of fun. They put a lot of effort into their game, as if you listen to our post-Halloween episode, you're aware of that, because it's the same group of people I'm playing Eberron with. But yeah, I prefer role-playing with people who actually role-play. I don't mind role-playing. Like, there is something for that. I've min-maxed a character before, and that power draw is exciting. But I don't think it should be all there is.
No, I think, because at that point you could just have a sheet of stats and a random number generator, and it doesn't mean anything, right? It's the story, I think, that really matters more. And like I said, I got to learn that more. I really embraced it when I really focused on being a game master rather than a player. And I love the role of game master, because I love setting up challenges for players and seeing them come up with solutions. One thing I would tell any aspiring game master out there is that never underestimate your players, and never like bank that the players are going to do a specific set of actions, because I can almost guarantee you they will pick some other thing to do, some other direction to go, and it'll be something you didn't think about. And then you've got to adapt on the fly. So it's better to like have an outline of what you want to have happen, but not to, you know, have it feel like it's scripted, because they don't have a script and they will not follow it.
And it doesn't matter how many clue by fours you give them, they're going to miss whatever path you're trying to put them on.
Yeah.
I see. It sounds like you like DMing, and it sounds like you kind of jumped into the deep end of DMing. I will never DM a tabletop, ever, ever, because I've been on plenty of plot committees, and I have learned that creating adventures for other people to run through is just not my cup of tea. I'm really good at coming up with ideas or filling in blanks or adjusting on the fly, but like just... yeah, being a part of the plot committee and making sure that the world is interesting for other people is very stressful to me.
Understandable.
And also, as a person who, you know, rules are not my first thought and something that I've I've gotten decent at them now, but I struggled with in the past. Like, I hated rules. Like, you have to really know the rules to DM. You can break them once you know them, but.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And if you are breaking them with intent, and because that is what's going to make a better adventure, that's great. If you go forward where it looks like you don't know what you're doing, then it just becomes not fun for everybody. So mm-hmm. there is, like, you do need to know them so that, you know, in times where you need to rely upon them because it will get you out of a jam, they are invaluable, right? There are going to be times where you're like, well, I can't see for a reason why you can't do that. So go ahead and roll. And then the roll comes out and you're like, all right, that roll was not good enough to do what you wanted it to do. So now you have to do what I wanted you to do. like that sometimes helps. It's when they make those darn rolls, those characters. I love world creation and I love creating the scenario that people have to play through. And the thing I learned was that just trying to make it flexible enough where it's okay if they don't go through every room. Mm-hmm. I mean, it might stink if you spent a long time setting something up that was particularly interesting or funny or entertaining and they just didn't go there. That does kind of, it stinks, but it doesn't mean that you've lost it. You can always find a way to pick it up and port it into some future adventure and still make use of it. It just won't be where you intended.
I mean, I get, this is where my mind is. Like and it's a lot harder to do in a LARP than it is in a tabletop. But if you, like, let's say you've got two rooms, one on the right and one on the left, and they don't go into the right room where you've got all the loot and the monsters, you just put them in the left room. If you're really
that's
that
also
set
true.
On it.
That's also true. You can also, you know, they don't know what's behind the other door. Yeah, that's a great point. Well, we have more to talk about with role-playing games, but first we're going to take a quick break. So Ariel, Ariel.
Yes.
Ariel.
Yes.
Ariel.
Yes.
So what if I pitch to you my idea for a D&D campaign, because I've got one that I've been working on and I was going to invite you, but you don't know about it yet. And this is all true.
Then I think that would be cool and I would like to hear it. And yeah, that would be awesome.
So, all right. First of all, full disclosure, my idea is heavily inspired by the most recent season of The Adventure Zone, which is called Ethersea, which is set under the ocean. It's underwater adventures, but it's using the basic D&D rules with a lot of interpretation.
You've already got me because you know I'm a little mermaid.
Well, except like that mine's not under the ocean. I was thinking of a world where once upon a time there was a lot more landmass, but because of this big cosmic event that happened thousands of years before the events of the players, the world was mostly drowned. And so now it's just chains of islands. And so it becomes more of a pirates kind of thing. That there's a lot more seafaring and all the different races have sort of adapted to this new reality with different ones doing different things. So like the gnomes have steamships that they use to get across the ocean. The elves have ships that leave no wake. They just skate across the water. You know, the dwarves have like big Viking ships whenever they leave, which is not often because
they
don't like going
out. Do you need
to be saying
TM after each of these ideas?
TM, 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 TM. And so my idea is that it would be the party, the adventuring party, would be made up of people who grew up in this world. They weren't there in the pre-days when everything was, you know, different. But they are one and the same with this world. Like, they know how it works. And mm-hmm. that a lot of the adventures would involve seafaring. It may not be that all of them take place on the sea, because I think that that would get repetitive. But it would have the characters themselves, the classes would all have a twist. So instead of your, you know, classic fighter, you would have like more like swashbuckler, mm-hmm. which might be kind of a fighter rogue sort of character. That kind of thing. So that's my pitch. Are you interested?
I am interested. So 5th edition, at least for Eberron, but I think it's in general, rogues already have a swashbuckling subclass.
Yes.
I know this because...
Because you play one?
Because I play one. So it was between swashbuckler, inquisitive, and mastermind, and I went with inquisitive. Because I'm...
Well, yeah, like, I think, because in the old 2nd edition D&D, they came out with the complete blank handbooks, and it was for each of the main classes. So I had the complete fighter's handbook, the complete thief's handbook, that kind of thing. And in these, they had tons and tons of subclasses that you could become instead of, you know, your standard thief or your standard fighter. And I know that 5th edition has done a lot of the same with that, with introducing it in various supplemental materials. So it would be kind of falling in that realm where swashbuckler is this kind of almost a class that spans fighter and thief a little bit. I also look forward to having bards, and their instruments include things like squeeze boxes, like the idea, like the stuff you would see in a pirate movie, or the kind of music that typically plays during pirate movies.
Okay, so I want to play your game, and I want to be a bardarian, which anybody who listens to this show knows that's like my thing. It's not really a dual class, but could totally be a dual class. And I'm going to bring like an actual like jug and squeeze box to your games. And learn to play them as we go. And I also request that we play like we rent a pontoon boat and play on it. And I know you're going to go, Ariel, what happens if we accidentally roll a dice off the ship? Like, who doesn't have so many dice that it's like it's not going to be a problem?
I mean, I got a place where we can do that. I've even got a boat dock that we can do that. So I'm just saying. This was like, it was silly for me to bring this up for this episode, but it really is something that I'm working on. It's kind of, that's sort of an indication of the kind of ideas I go for when I'm creating a game world. Like, to me, that's one of the biggest responsibilities of a game master. And there are a lot of resources out there for lots of different games where they have established game worlds, whether they are based on the real world or it's some fantasy or science fiction world that has its own history, you know, like the Star Wars universe, or tons of Dungeons and Dragons. Like there's the Forgotten Realms and there's the Greyhawk setting and the Dragonlance setting. So there are a lot of different options to go with. I always loved creating my own, although I will borrow heavily from existing material because I am not Tolkien. I cannot go through every single step of creating every single element of a world and its mythology.
You don't have to tell people that. They will think that you can, even when you're making it up on the fly. I mean,
you are praying to your god of Roscoe, god of canned goods.
Yes. So it's interesting that you said Tolkien though, because like I didn't start gaming till I was a teenager, anything beyond like computer games or maybe like text-based adventures. But, you know, that love of fantasy was already there because my mom raised me on things like King Arthur's Court and Lord of the Rings and, you know, sci-fi and stuff like that. So, you know, it is interesting that a lot of those things are what inspire a lot of the games nowadays or whatnot.
Well, let me ask you this. What are some of your, I mean, we know you love to play barbarians, particularly in LARPs, because you like to swing big foam axes and whack people on the head.
And also but, because I don't have to remember a lot of political information.
I like playing characters where it's just point me in the way of the fight and I'll go and swing things.
I can make funny jokes and I can hit things and I don't need to invest a lot of time actually learning world history. I love world history. But oftentimes I just don't have time. Okay, continue on. Bunny trail over.
Do you have any favorite characters or character types that you've encountered, whether you were playing them or someone else was, that just stick out in your mind as being like, this is something that I never would have experienced without role playing?
In my first LARP, I had an acting troupe. There was an acting troupe in the LARP, and they did Commedia dell'arte stuff. Mm-hmm. And that was my introduction to Commedia dell'arte. So I would not have experienced that without gaming. But other than that, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I've my friends get really creative with their characters.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like I've seen it all.
I mean, like there's some that just stick with me that like, it's not that the character was unique to the point of it being, you know, super special, but I'll never forget that one of the reasons why I wanted to do this high seas version of D&D is that when I was a game master as a teenager, one of the players in my game created a gnome swashbuckler. So a swashbuckler who's 3 feet tall and yet has a long cape and a big musketeer style hat and considers himself suave. And this is before I'd ever read the Terry Pratchett novels, where there is a character in the Terry Pratchett novels that's very similar to this. But it was one of my favorite characters because the player was treating the character seriously, but obviously the character itself was a joke. But it was in that transition of the player treating it like it's very serious, but everything that comes out is very funny. That just, it was one of those interactions that you think of with friends and you think, this is like a genuinely good time and I'm very much enjoying myself. That was the kind mm-hmm. of experience that came out to me.
Gotcha. I mean, I guess I game with really good people because they all do the thing where they find their opposites in the character. And so their characters are not one note. You know, they aren't just a fighter. Even like when I played a barbarian and I played with one of my friends, Caitlin, who she's just like my favorite person to team up with in a LARP. And we inevitably do so often because we'll both build kind of kick-ass characters. And then like when I was a barbarian, she was like a Viking. And then we teamed up and we started a bakery together. And we were the battle bakers.
Buy our muffins or suffer.
But we were the battle bakers. We'd go around with our baked goods that we made before each game and deliver them door to door for in-game money. And then like put our baskets down and fight monsters. It was just, yeah.
Yeah, so,
it's hard to pick a favorite.
Out of curiosity, like, so I'm sure a lot of our listeners have had at least some experience with role-playing games, but for those who don't, are there any in particular that you would recommend for people who are interested in role-playing games, but they don't know where to start?
If you're playing, yes. The recommendation I'm about to make is not as great if you are DMing, unless you just really like creative writing, and that would be Monster of the Week. The way that game is as a player, if you want to ease into some rules, is you role play everything and you just try to come up with solutions. And then at a certain point, your DM will say, that's going to require a roll. And that's when you bring in the stats and things like that. So
right.
it's really great, I think, for dipping your toes in if you are not rules minded. Like I said, 7Cs is another really good one, but you just have to be, there's lots of options for lots of types of characters you can play, but it is more political. And it's kind of set in a mirror, like Renaissance world to ours. So like that has to be your sort of jam. I love Dungeons and Dragons. Fifth edition has certainly made some things easier, but I don't think it's a great beginner game.
No, I agree. I think it's almost unfortunate that Dungeons and Dragons is associated so closely with role-playing games that for some people they mean the same thing. They're synonymous. Mm-hmm. And it is unfortunate because as much as I love D&D, and I love it a lot, it is a difficult system. It could be inscrutable to someone who's just joining, especially when you consider how many supplemental materials come out that expand mm-hmm. upon the basic rules that are already pretty complicated. I mean, there are all these different dice that are involved, and there are all these different types of rules that can apply to any given situation. It's daunting, and it is unfortunate that became the standard bearer for role-playing games, because there are other role-playing games out there that are easier, that are more friendly to newbies, and when it's easier, depending on how much burden it puts on the game master, it can just be a lot more fun. Some of these easy games require you to have a whip smart game master because they're essentially calling all the shots. Like, all the weight has been taken off the players and then put on the game master to tell a good story.
So what, because you have that, you have a lot more DM experience than I have, what would be your recommended starter game for a player? And then also your recommended starter game for a dungeon master or someone wanting to run a game for their friends who want to play?
Gosh. Okay. Well, I mean, so here's the unfortunate thing is because I haven't been playing in so long, I've been out of the quote unquote game so long, that my recommendations are all, like, a lot of them are out of print. You would have to really dig them up to find them. I think a game that's pretty easy to run is, as I recall, is Ghostbusters, because first of all, everyone's familiar with the setting. The rules are pretty simple and it's meant to be funny, so you don't have to worry too much about being hard and fast with the rules. If I were telling people, like, if you really wanted to play some fun Dungeons and Dragons games, like some fun adventures, if you could find a copy of Castle Greyhawk, which those adventures include some of the most fun adventures in there, both serious and comedic. There's some very funny ones in there. Those would be the ones I would recommend to people interested in that kind of stuff. If you want to think about world building, I suggest listening to podcasts that are dedicated to D&D and there, or role-playing in general. And there are tons of them. I mean, I mentioned the Adventure Zone, which is a very loosey-goosey kind of approach to role-playing, but it focuses more on storytelling, particularly after you get past the first 10 or so episodes of the first season. But there are other ones out there too that are a little more serious and a little more in-depth. That there's no shortage of them, but it'll give you an appreciation for the process of world building if you should get an itch to do it yourself.
Yeah. So I think that they came out with some new Greyhawk stuff a few years back, but I couldn't be certain. Also, if, like, you don't want to build a world and you don't want to create a character, but you do want to kind of toy at role playing, as long as you don't get mad at your friends very easily, you could play BSG the board game. If you like Battlestar Galactica, the new series, and just role play those characters. It's really funny if you do. have to go in with a lot
until
of humor.
Until it turns out that you were betraying everyone the whole time.
I mean, best story, I was playing with some friends and one of them was Gaius Baltar, and Gaius Baltar gets three. You get cards that show your loyalty. Gaius Baltar gets three. So he has an extra chance of being the bad guy. And my friend was playing it like Gaius Baltar. We'd have a check where we'd have to put in a certain number of whatever to beat it. And he'd be like, no, I got this, guys. And he'd put in something that would hurt us. And we found out that he wasn't a bad guy. He wasn't a Cylon. He was just playing like the character. And half of my friends got really upset. And the other half of my friends absolutely love it. I'm in the love it camp because I'm like, yeah, you know, That's what the character would do, and the character wasn't a Cylon. Spoilers if you haven't watched BSG.
That game is kind of similar to some of the identity-based games like Werewolf and Mafia and that kind of thing. It has some elements of that. And that is a discussion that we'll have to hold off for another day, and I can tell you about why I hate the game Werewolf. But for now, we need to go to break, and when we come back, we're going to take on a role ourselves. We're going to take on the role of screenwriters, pitching our brand new movie mashup idea after these messages.
All right, so we're back, and our mashup this week is just inspired by a really good adventuring party, the hobbits, etc., from Lord of the Rings. And then just what the heck can we throw with it, which is the Predator. So that's our mashup.
So you said, like, the hobbits in general. I chose The Hobbit, the actual, the original novel, which is still my favorite book of all time. I got a copy of it sitting out of frame of camera, which no one listening to this can see, but Ariel Ariel also can't see it because it's out of frame. So anyway, The Hobbit's my favorite book, and it's, you know, obviously it's a fantasy story about a hobbit named Bilbo Baggins who goes on an adventure with a bunch of dwarves in order for them to defeat a dragon that had taken over their ancestral home of the Lonely Mountain. I almost said Lonely Island, but that's a different thing.
That would be funny, though.
It would be. Dwarf in a box. The Lonely Mountain. And then, of course, you have Lord of the Rings, which I'm sure everyone listening is familiar with because Peter Jackson made sure of it. And then we have Predator.
Yes, and you Predator. You want
to explain Predator?
I was just about to. Predator is, and I'm going to explain it poorly because I have watched these movies, but it's been a bit. Predator is about these aliens that come to Earth and hunt for, like, basically, like, biggest challenges, big quarry. So people, xenomorphs, whatever. Yeah,
usually it's humans because we're the most dangerous game.
Yes, yes. And they have heat vision, so they can see your body heat. And that's kind of at least how they look when they're looking through, like, their helmets, what they do. They've got real ugly faces.
We get alien point of view shots where it's always thermal vision.
Yes. And so, like, that's really it. The first Predator takes place in, like, the jungles of South America near Guatemala. And then the second one takes place in, like, New York City. And then I haven't watched beyond that, but.
They quickly go off the rails. Yeah. Like you mentioned, there is a Alien versus Predator movie. And then there was the more recent The Predator, which less said about that, the better, in my opinion. But so we're going to mash these things up. And who do you want to go first?
I'll go first. Okay. And I went with the very first Predator, which was in the jungles of South America / Guatemala, where Arnold Schwarzenegger played the main character, Major Alan Dutch Schaefer. All right, this is called The Predator. Anna Gonzalez survived a lot of things. She was a guerrilla military person. But after surviving the Predator attack and Major Alan Dutch Schaefer, she decided not to test her luck any further and made her way home to Guatemala to live a quiet rest of her life. However, shortly after settling down, Volcán de Fuego erupted, the volcano that is active in Guatemala. And while she made it through the eruption, something was off. She would often feel like there was something or someone invisible following her around. Cold breezes would blow by in still rooms, quiet footsteps in empty hallways, and pantries ransacked. She tried to shrug it off as maybe a mouse or a rat, but she felt as if she was being stalked. Then reports started coming in from all over the neighborhood. People's fish tanks, hen houses, pet rabbits, and other livestock were being slaughtered by an invisible force. Anna was sure that the Predator had changed its mind and was after her to finish its kill and was just toying with her. Also forgot to mention, predators can go invisible. And so she prepared for the worst. Then one day, while she was cooking a late breakfast, it happened. She heard a clatter in her kitchen, cut to heat vision of Anna in the stove. She turned around, spatula in hand. Cut to heat vision, looking from Anna to the stove. She heard a hiss. Did it say 11 C's? Cut to heat vision, running towards Anna and the stove. She was tackled to the ground by an invisible force. She struggled with it and heard a small metal clatter on the floor. And that's when the creature appeared in front of her face. Small, furry-footed, chomping wildly. A small blade in hand. She couldn't tell if it was a kitchen knife or some fantastical weapon. This was not like any predator she had seen before. But then the creature lunged past Anna and started devouring her food on the stove. Sausages, potatoes, bread. It scoured every inch of the kitchen, eating all the food before it realized it could be seen. Anna grabbed a kitchen knife of her own and cornered it against some cabinets. The creature looked around, confused, and started gaining its composure. She asked, "What kind of predator are you?" as it inched towards where the metal clattering occurred. And it spoke. It said, "I'm Peregrine Took, not a predator. Well, I guess I am. Hobbit, maybe? Maybe I am a predator. I do eat game. I fell into or came out of a volcano." It seemed really confused. But then it was not confused on one item. It said, "I need food." It ran to the small metal object, which was a ring that had made the clattering noise, and slipped it on, and it was gone. Anna heard screams as other people's houses were being ransacked by an invisible force. But after the life she had led, she realized that this problem wasn't so bad. And she went back to her retirement. but not before putting locks on all of her pantries. The Hobbit predator creature became a feared legend in the neighborhood. The locals call it the Breditor for its penchant for breakfast foods. The end.
Not only is it raiding breakfast foods, it does so twice a day.
Twice a day.
I mean, second breakfast.
Technically, like in my mind canon, it just eats constantly. Like everybody is starving.
I mean, when you look at the story, when you look at the story of the Hobbit, and they lay out how many meals the Hobbits have, that's pretty close. They are pretty much constantly eating. All right, here's mine. Mine is titled The Predator or There and Back Again. Bilbo Baggins has a problem. This tall old dude who shoots fireworks out of a stick invited a ton of folks to his house without asking permission first. There's Feely and Keely and Oin and Gloin and Dutch and Poncho and Blaine and Billy. It's your typical mixture of dwarves and CIA-backed military rescue team members. The usual, in other words. Turns out the visitors want Bilbo to come along with them on a mission. That mission? To infiltrate the Lonely Mountain and to rescue a government official. Apparently the official was captured by a dragon. Bilbo is not super keen on going, but then Sergeant Blaine Cooper uses some really hurtful language to shame him into participating, and we come to realize that the dwarves are pretty greedy so-and-sos with a chip on their shoulder for getting kicked out of their ancestral homeland, and the military team is made up of a lot of misogynistic homophobes. But anyway, Bilbo's convinced to go, and partly out of a sense of adventure, and partly because Blaine scares him a lot. So Dutch, the leader of the group, does this thing where he reaches out his hand for Bilbo to take, and then Dutch flexes like super big, like super, super big, like he wants to do some sort of arm wrestling thing in the air with Bilbo. But Bilbo's this tiny little thing, so he ends up getting thrown across the room, and then everybody laughs, apart from Bilbo. And then they're off. They begin their journey, and once they leave the safety of civilization, things take a turn. There's this one point, right, where like the whole group, except for the old guy with the fireworks stick, get caught by these giant trolls. But then the old guy tricks the trolls into sticking around until daybreak, and that's when the trolls turn to stone, so it's all okay. They keep on going until they reach the Misty Mountains, and as they make their way through a treacherous pass, they find a place to sleep in a cave and they hole up, but the cave ends up connecting to a network of other caves that are all inhabited by goblins, which is a real bummer. And that leads us on this big adventure in which, you know, the dwarves and the military guys and the old dude and Bilbo all get separated. And Bilbo ends up going down the wrong path as goblins are chasing him, and he finds himself in a subterranean lake. There he hears this weird chattering, clicking noise, and there's something moving around. But Bilbo can't really see anything. There's just this sort of shimmering figure that is going on. It's like something was there, but it's blending in with the background. Well, Bilbo quietly slips into the water, which is good because it turns out this thing, it has this cool POV shot we get, and we're going into thermal vision, but then, you know, because Bilbo has gone into cold water, he's not really showing up so well. So whatever this thing is, it doesn't really see Bilbo. But eventually, the thing shimmers into appearance, and we see it's a predator. Only he's kind of short for a predator, but he's got that wild helmet and, you know, like the gauntlet and the cool armor and stuff. And Bilbo, aghast, stays very still.
"We knows it's in here, don't we, my precious?" says this voice, and Bilbo remains silent, listening. "We wants to play with it, don't we? Does it like riddles?" asks the predator.
"Riddles? What are you on about?" asks Bilbo.
"Ah, so it understands us. Riddles! Riddles, we asks it, and if it doesn't answer, we eats it. But if it asks us and we do not answer, we lets it go," says the predator.
"Fine, here's my riddle. What does Sergeant Blaine not have time for?" asks Bilbo.
"Whoa," says the predator. "We thinks it has cheated."
"Nope," says Bilbo. "This is a famous quote. It's on IMDb and everything. What does Sergeant Blaine not have time for?"
"Well, crap," says the predator. "I don't get out much. Chit-chat?"
"Wrong," says Bilbo.
"He ain't got time to bleed. I win."
And the predator lets out a howl and then says, "Well, come on out. You won." Well, Bilbo knows better than that. And this whole time, he's been quietly sneaking up on the predator. So then he jumps out of the water and plunges his dagger sting into the predator's side. And there's this big fight. And Bilbo gets bashed around a lot. And he nearly gets taken out with this like shoulder-mounted predator cannon. But he eventually wins. And after winning, he curiously removes the predator mask, only to reveal that underneath wasn't a predator alien at all. I know, I was like totally surprised too. No, guys, it was Andy Serkis. So Bilbo takes the predator armor and he puts it on, and this lets him go all invisible. Well, we all know how this story ends, right? Most of the team ends up dying, but some of them make it to the mountain, and then Bilbo sneaks in because, you know, he's wearing the predator armor, and he uses an arm-mounted laser to blast the dragon into ash, killing him instantly, and then everyone heads to the choppa. Wait, no, I mean they head to the eagles. The end.
No, I really like the mashup. I'm still stuck on Andy Serkis being under the predator mask, which
I
mean, makes sense.
I gotta subvert your expectations.
Yeah. But once again, you show that sometimes our wildest ideas are actually a match made in heaven. Who would have thought that there were so many similarities between The Predator and The Hobbit?
The Hobbit. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's, I mean, really, they're a hair's breadth apart, like two sides of the same coin when you get down to it.
A couple of conies.
Yeah. All right. Well, that wraps up this buffer episode of Large Nerd Drunk Collider. Hope you enjoyed it. If you have suggestions for things we should mash up in the future, or maybe you've got your own mix up of The Hobbit and The Predator, or maybe you've got stuff to say about role-playing games. Like if there's a favorite you have that you think is great and more people need to play, let us know. We would love to hear it. And the best way to do that is to send us an email. The email address for the show is lnc@iheartmedia.com.
Yep, you can also reach out to us on social media. On Twitter, we're LNC_podcast, and on Instagram, we're Large Nerdron Collider. We really do love hearing from you. And we'd also love your friends to hear from you as well. If you like the show, please share it with them, or really anybody you know who's a geek or geek adjacent. You know, like the show, leave a review, and we love you.
Yes, and until next time, I'm Jonathan, make a saving throw, Strickland.
And I am Ariel, natural one, Kasten.
Oh, I was gonna call you a natural 20.
Aw, shucks.
The Large Nerdron Collider is a production of iHeartRadio and was created by Ariel Kasten. Jonathan Strickland is the executive producer. The show is produced, edited, and published by Tari Harrison. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.